Israeli officials say military forces remain inside the Gaza Strip's largest hospital, Shifa, after raiding it for a second time in 24 hours.
The army says that they have proof that the hospital was used by Hamas as a command and control center, and that they thought that perhaps hostages were being held underneath the hospital in tunnels.
U.S. President Joe Biden met with Chinese President Xi Jinping on Wednesday outside of San Francisco, where leaders of Asia-Pacific economies are gathering.
A historic meeting of East and West after 12 months of intense drama and diplomacy between Beijing and Washington.
And the U.S. Senate passes a stopgap spending bill to avert a government shutdown. Today is Friday, November 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Kim Lewis. Israeli officials say their military forces remained inside the Gaza Strip's largest hospital, Shifa, after raiding it for a second time in 24 hours. VOA's Rick Pantaleo spoke with correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Israeli forces remained inside Shifa, the Gaza Strip's main hospital, after storming it for a second time in 24 hours. What is the IDF doing in the hospital?
Well, the army says that they have proof that the hospital was used by Hamas as a command and control center, and that they thought that perhaps hostages were being held underneath the hospital in tunnels. They actually found the body of one of the hostages, a 64-year-old Israeli woman who had been battling breast cancer, and her body was found near the hospital. So they're kind of going through the hospital room by room, looking at whatever computers they have. They made a video of three duffel bags they found with guns and various other Hamas equipment, but they did not find any proof that the hostages were being held at the hospital.
Beside the woman they found dead today, have there been any other reports of hostages that have been killed?
No. I mean, you know, I think Israel sort of assumes that at least some of the hostages are dead, either having been killed or having died from their wounds that they suffered on October 7th. Some of the doctors of the hostages said that several of the elderly hostages had some medical conditions that they would have been very vulnerable without their medicine. And of course, when they were kidnapped, they didn't have their medicine. And for example, I know of one hostage, Hirsch Goldberg Poland, who is the son of friends of mine, and his arm was blown off at the elbow. It's hard to believe that he would have gotten the complex medical care that he would need.
Now, according to Israeli police and military, an IDF soldier was killed and at least six others have been recently injured in attacks at checkpoints in Jerusalem.
Yes, so that happened this morning, actually not far from my home in Jerusalem. And Israel says that the three terrorists were on their way to Jerusalem to commit a larger terror attack. And when they were stopped by Israeli soldiers, they opened fire, killing one soldier and wounding the others. And Israel is definitely on high alert for more attacks like that.
Israeli officials said that they were opening an investigation into crimes committed during the Hamas October 7th attack, and this includes accusations of sexual violence. Have you heard about this investigation?
Yes. In fact, some feminist groups in Israel say they've been very disappointed by the fact that feminist groups worldwide have not sort of spoken up. There are testimonies by Hamas terrorists who have been captured who say that they raped women and that that was one of the goals, was to rape women. And the problem is that there's not a lot of forensic evidence because Israel was so concerned about identifying the bodies. And even now, 41 days later, some have not been identified, or they're coming up with new findings because some of the bodies were burned, and forensic evidence doesn't last that long. However, it seems to be quite clear that there was a lot of rape and a lot of other sexual crimes committed against women.
Linda Gradstein, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem, who spoke with my colleague Rick Pantaleo. U.S. President Joe Biden met with Chinese President Xi Jinping on Wednesday outside of San Francisco, where leaders of Asia-Pacific economies are gathering. Biden, who said he still sees the Chinese leader as a dictator, said the two agreed to reestablish military communications, work together to assess the threats posed by artificial intelligence, and take meaningful steps to combat the scourge of fentanyl. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Woodside, California.
A historic meeting of East and West after 12 months of intense drama and diplomacy between Beijing and Washington. The White House chose this venue outside of San Francisco for this symbolic visit, covering a range of key issues, including Taiwan, the self-governing island that China claims, the resumption of military communications, touchy trade agreements, the origination of fentanyl ingredients in China, and human rights issues. Biden said he was candid on those tough issues. She said the two nations are inextricably linked.
For two large countries like China and the United States, turning their back on each other is not an option. It is unrealistic for one side to remodel the other, and conflict and confrontation has unbearable consequences for both sides.
So did the presidents of the world's two most powerful nations manage to paper over the cracks in their relationship? Biden spoke to the press afterward. She, as is his habit, did not.
I welcome the positive steps we've taken today. And it's important for the world to see that we're implementing the approach in the best traditions of American diplomacy. We're talking to our competitors and the key and just talking, just being blunt with one another. So there's no misunderstanding as a key element to maintaining global stability and delivering for the American people.
But in response to a shouted question, he reiterated a stance that is likely to upset Beijing, that he believes Xi is a dictator.
Well, look, he is. I mean, he's a dictator.
Many watching this meeting said they weren't expecting major results, but are glad the two are talking. Malaysian Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim at an event of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit on Wednesday.
This engagement, for example, between President Biden and Xi Jinping, to me, it is critical because it should give a clear message that we are here to be able to work together and trust each other to resolve serious problems, climate issues in Ukraine or Gaza. There are too many contentious issues in the world, and you must try and engage.
Analysts say the success of the Summit of Asia-Pacific Economies, happening simultaneously in San Francisco, depends on the world's two largest economies getting along. Michael Froman is president of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, I think it's an important meeting between President Biden and President Xi, with the primary goal of stabilizing the relationship heading into 2024. I think both for bilateral purposes, but also very importantly for the broader APEC region. The countries there, the economies there, want the U.S. and China to have some kind of modus vivendi, some kind of stable relationship, particularly in anticipation of Taiwan's election in January, the U.S. election in November.
Biden said he and Xi will continue to communicate and cooperate. The world, he said, expects it. Anita Powell, VOA News, Woodside, California.
We're following these other stories from around the world. The director of a hospital in Haiti says a heavily armed gang surrounded the medical center and trapped women, children, and newborns inside until police rescued them. He told the Associated Press that gangs were torching homes surrounding the hospital and preventing everyone inside from leaving. The hospital has been considered an oasis in a community overrun by gangs that have unleashed increasingly violent attacks against each other and civilians. The United Press Institute said unidentified gunmen killed one journalist and abducted two other journalists earlier this month in Mali, underscoring the threats facing the media in the region. It is unclear whether the journalists were targeted for their work. The gunmen asked their families to pay nearly $5,000 in ransom for each journalist. The United Kingdom's top foreign diplomat, David Cameron, traveled to the port of Odessa on Thursday to pledge continued support for the Ukrainian war effort. Cameron's visit marks the first that the former British Prime Minister has taken since being named to his new role of foreign minister. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Kim Lewis. The U.S. Senate passed a stopgap spending bill Wednesday night to avoid a government shutdown. It now heads to President Biden to sign. But Congress failed to reach an agreement on war effort assistance to Israel and Ukraine. I asked Jim Kessler, Executive Vice President for Policy at Third Way, what this means for each of the countries dealing with conflict.
Well, it means that, you know, we haven't resolved some of the biggest issues, you know, with our budget in America. And, you know, it's unfortunate that particularly with Ukraine, that has become a divisive issue in the United States Congress. I believe it is going to get resolved. The Republicans are going to want some border measures in there for the U.S.-Mexico border. If they're reasonable, Democrats will go for it. I'm sure Joe Biden would go for it. But it's a shame it had to resort to that.
Also, as you mentioned, lawmakers are still negotiating on the spending levels for 2024, as well as President Biden's $106 billion National Security Emergency Supplemental request, which does include funds for both Ukraine and Israel. So we will see if that is worked out. But what can we expect in the coming weeks?
On the continuing resolution that got passed, what it means is for much of the government, you know, funding is all set at least through the year, and for some, it's through February. So, you know, federal workers, sigh of relief. On some of the immediate issues that are out there, particularly regarding some of the conflicts that, you know, where America is involved, you know, at least in an advisory or in a supportive role financially, that is unresolved. And these conflicts, like, it matters on a day-to-day basis. So I think after Thanksgiving, you're going to see Congress get back together and try and resolve this as quickly as possible. You know, again, the problem is on the Republican side for the most part. They are divided on Ukraine. They're not divided on Israel. But, you know, and as much as there are some Democrats who are concerned about the Israel funding, certainly not enough to derail the funding.
And also in other U.S. politics, New York Republican Representative George Santos announced that he's dropping his bid for a second term after a new report by the House Ethics Committee says a congressional probe found evidence of, quote, alleged violations, unquote, by Santos that go beyond crimes detailed in the Justice Department's indictments. So what can we expect to happen in this investigation?
Well, right now, Congressman Santos is buying time. He announced he wasn't going to run for re-election, really, in order to keep his job for the next year, okay? And it's his way of telling Republicans, you know, don't go for expulsion because I'm going to be leaving on my own. He needs to be expelled. And to do that, you need a two-thirds majority in the House. This Ethics Committee report, it could be the nail in the coffin for him, but the House of Representatives is going to have to act. One of the complicating factors on this is that if Santos leaves, that seat will likely be won by a Democrat. So that thin 222 to 213 majority that Speaker Mike Johnson has will become 221 to 214, and every vote counts in the House.
Jim Kessler, Executive Vice President for Policy at Third Way. The Associated Press says a gag order that barred Donald Trump from commenting about court personnel after he disparaged a law clerk in his New York civil fraud trial was temporarily lifted Thursday by an appellate judge who raised free speech concerns. Judge David Friedman of the state's Intermediate Appeals Court issued what's known as a stay, suspending the gag order and allowing the former president to freely comment about court staff while a longer appeals process plays out. The trial judge, Arthur Engoron, imposed the gag order on October 3rd after Trump made a false comment about the judge's law clerk on social media. Journalists from India, Togo, Georgia, and Mexico this week are being honored with International Press Freedom Awards. The legal threats and harassment all four confront reflect a wider downward trend in civil liberties, they say. For Liam Scott, VOA's Jessica Jarit has more.
For 13 years, Shahina KK has been living under a legal cloud. Based in the city of Kochi, the editor for Outlook magazine is one of the first journalists charged under India's anti-terror laws in connection with her reporting. She's been facing legal action since 2010 and says pressure on journalists like her have only become more common.
15 years ago or 20 years ago, it was an exception. You know, journalists being booked was an exception. Now it has become a norm.
Governments using laws to target journalists isn't just happening in India, says Shahina.
I think it's a global phenomenon. It's happening everywhere. And in India also, as everybody knows, the Indian situation is going from bad to worse.
Shahina is one of four journalists recognized this week with an International Press Freedom Award. All are confronting legal or other harassment. Presented by the Committee to Protect Journalists, the award also was given to Nico Gravamia from Georgia, Maria Teresa Montana from Mexico, and Ferdinand Ayete of Togo.
I think what unites the four awardees this year are some of the themes we're seeing globally. So, increased criminalization of journalists, in particular using non-speech-related charges against them, charges like breaches of national security law, for example.
While in the US, the journalists are meeting with lawmakers, civil society and news outlets, including VOA, to discuss the situation for media in their respective countries. With press freedom at risk around the world, Ginsburg says it's especially important for US lawmakers to hear their stories.
The United States prides itself as the home of the First Amendment, a defender of the free press. And so it's really important that US lawmakers hear firsthand the kinds of threats that we are seeing worldwide, not just so that they can help protect those journalists internationally, but also so that they understand what might happen here in the United States if we don't also defend a free press here.
With India, Mexico and Georgia all scheduled to hold elections in 2024, the threats to media mirror threats to democracy as a whole, the journalists say. Gravamia, who spent 13 months in prison, says Russian influence is a concern in his home country of Georgia.
The problems in Georgia is not a matter of bad governance. It's an issue of Russian-backed authoritarianism. So that is most important issue we have to understand about Georgia.
Shahina too says the 2024 elections in India are a concern.
Everyone who is worried about democracy, secularism and federalism in India are deeply concerned about the upcoming election.
The Press Freedom Awards Gala in New York Thursday will offer a brief pause before the honorees return to covering the news. For Liam Scott, Jessica Jarit, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency's Integral Space Telescope has detected a huge gamma ray burst generated by a star that exploded in a supernova located some 2.4 billion light years away. According to ESA, this gamma ray burst produced a significant disturbance in Earth's ionosphere, which is located between 48 to 965 kilometers above sea level. Researchers who investigated this detection outlined their findings in a new study that has been published in the journal Nature Communications. Study lead author Mirko Piersanti of the University of Laquia, Italy, says it was probably the brightest and strongest gamma ray burst that his team ever detected. ESA says the burst provided enough power to trigger lightning detectors in India. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
The assassination of U.S. President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 60 years ago, put the Texas School Book Depository Building on the map of history. As VOA's King Farabaugh reports, despite several efforts to tear down the structure over the decades, the old warehouse is now both a museum about the tragedy and a memorial to President Kennedy.
Professor Jeffrey Engel of Southern Methodist University in Dallas says community leaders long struggled to balance the reality of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy with the way it negatively impacted the city.
The Kennedy assassination confirmed the identity of Dallas in American minds. Dallas was a place that was known at the time as a hateful, dark city in many ways on a national scene in terms of politics.
It was an unfair characterization, but it lingered as a dark cloud over this community for decades.
Stephen Fagan is the curator of the Sixth Floor Museum, which now occupies the sixth floor of the former Texas School Book Depository, where investigators say Lee Harvey Oswald fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
We are a historical institution that explores the life, death, and legacy of President Kennedy and the broader history and culture of the 1960s.
The sixth-floor museum, situated at the edge of Dealey Plaza, opened in 1989 and quickly became a top tourist destination, says Professor Engel of Southern Methodist University.
Dealey Plaza is the second most visited tourist attraction in the state of Texas, right after the Alamo.
Stephen Fagan of the Sixth Floor Museum.
There are sites in this country that are stained by violence and tragedy. Dealey Plaza is one of those, much like Pearl Harbor or the footprint of the World Trade Center. And sites like this allow us to do justice to a tragic event by remembering it properly.
Fagan says remembering it properly does not mean the Sixth Floor Museum draws definitive conclusions about exactly what happened in Dallas in November of 1963.
Well, the assassination, like so many other things, it's a very divisive topic. People typically arrive here knowing whether they believe Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone or whether there was a conspiracy.
Professor Engel says many museum visitors are more than merely curious.
The Kennedy conspiracy theorists still hold a grip on the nation's psyche in some ways, that you can go to Dealey Plaza and tell yourself, I've heard the story. Maybe I can piece it together a little bit myself now differently because I've seen it with my own eyes.
Again, Stephen Fagan.
You may be intrigued by the nuances of the assassination, the lingering questions surrounding bullet trajectories and medical evidence, but at the end of the day, something died here, and Dealey Plaza sort of stands for that unfulfilled hope and promise that John F. Kennedy represented.
The Sixth Floor Museum is not just a series of exhibits, it is also an archive. Some of the film footage of the assassination is preserved and licensed by the museum, as are recordings of oral histories of eyewitnesses and key figures in the events. Collectively, they fill the Sixth Floor Museum with more than just physical artifacts that help put a watershed moment of the 20th century into perspective, historically and locally.
This museum, I think, has played a very key role in helping this community kind of exorcise the last remaining demons from 1963.
A museum which records attendance of more than 300,000 guests annually from 133 countries. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Dallas, Texas.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Kim Lewis. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the face of urgent global challenges, it's more important than ever that the world's two largest democracies, the United States and India, exchange views, find common goals, and deliver for our people, declared Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin at the recent U.S.-India 2+2 ministerial dialogue.
We've made impressive gains in building our major defense partnership over the past year, and that will help us contribute even more together to the cause of peace and stability. We're integrating our industrial bases, strengthening our interoperability, and sharing cutting-edge technology.
Our increasingly strong ties give us all hope for the future of this partnership and for our common efforts toward a more secure world, said Defense Secretary Austin. Indeed, Secretary of State Antony Blinken noted that President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Narendra Modi have set out an ambitious agenda to build a stronger and more comprehensive strategic partnership.
We are promoting a free and open, prosperous, secure, and resilient Indo-Pacific, including by strengthening our partnership through the Quad with Japan and Australia. One significant way we're doing that is by enhancing maritime domain awareness, sharing commercial satellite data with countries in the region to boost their capacity, for example, to combat illegal fishing, piracy, drug trafficking. We're also coordinating humanitarian relief and disaster response efforts in the Indo-Pacific.
On the economic front, the U.S. and India are focused on innovation, noted Secretary Blinken.
That's evident in the cooperation on semiconductors and advanced biotechnology, on our unprecedented investments in deploying clean energy at scale in our countries as well as across the region, and our joint research and exploration projects in space.
With regard to international peace and security, the U.S. and India are working to promote a rules-based order and uphold the principles at the heart of the United Nations Charter: sovereignty, territorial integrity, and independence. Finally, we're deepening the remarkable ties between our people, said Secretary Blinken. If there's one thing we've learned over the recent decades, it's that when Indians and Americans study together, work together, collaborate together, the possibilities for progress are infinite. This is a moment in history that requires determination and collaboration, noted Secretary Blinken. And it only underscores how vital the U.S.-India partnership is and how important our efforts are to further strengthen it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.